You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Good morning. Is it working okay? Yep, good morning. Well, excellent, we have a festival. Thank goodness for that. Hooray! And welcome to the Climate Change Breakfast Club. I feel like let's be grateful that the worst extreme weather event we have to worry about right now is whether or not our tents are going to blow away. And mostly they haven't. So that's about as rough as it gets in this country, mostly. So this is a climate change session, but it's not going to be a bad news session. It's definitely going to be a hopeful session. But it would seem wrong to plunge in to talking about diplomacy and all of that without just saying something about the context, just a word about the context. And it's almost exactly 1 month since the world's hottest day in measured history, in the period in which we've had confident measurement. That's not really a surprise because we're on an upward trend, as we all know. June this year was the 12th consecutive month where the global average temperature was 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial average. In other words, above the level that we've all agreed that we want to keep it below, 12 months consecutive. Again, you could say that's not very surprising, but actually there's been a really significant jump of about half a degree or so in the last couple of years, and the scientists don't really know yet why that's happening. The chair of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has said we're in uncharted territory and the change is happening much more quickly than we expected. And of course, what really matters is not the range of temperature in recorded human history in the last 10,000 years or so of human civilization, when temperatures have been really stable. They haven't gone up or down by more than half a degree. What matters is when we look at the paleoclimate history, then we can see that in the past, global temperatures have been up to 10 degrees higher and sea level has been 100 meters higher. So we know that's the level of change that the climate system is capable of. It's just because we haven't witnessed it. We don't have precise measurements. We don't yet have computer models that can tell us how quickly that might happen again. But that is the level of change that we're talking about, far outside human experience, wildly different from the period of stability in which human civilization has developed. So that's why we have to be worried. That's why we have to do absolutely the best we can in every way to address the problem. Now, the reason this is a hopeful session is because one of the important ways that we're addressing climate change, we're doing really badly. And I always think if we were tackling climate change like Roger Federer plays tennis and still losing, then we'd be really hopeless. But since we're addressing climate change more like the way that I play tennis, which is really badly, there's hope. We can do much better. And so the particular focus of this talk is the diplomacy of climate change. Diplomacy is what I've worked on in most of my working life. And so I feel qualified to say that we're doing it really badly. Now, roughly, we've had about 30 years of climate change diplomacy, more than that, in fact. In 1992, there was the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, where countries all agreed this is a problem and we should do something about it. We should stop emitting greenhouse gases, stabilize their concentrations in the atmosphere, avoid dangerous anthropogenic interference with the climate system. That's what we said 32 years ago. Now, there's been a fairly consistent approach since then. The logic was that to avoid completely messing up the climate, we have to completely stop greenhouse gas emissions. So that means there's a finite greenhouse gas emission budget, a finite pie. So what countries should do is agree how big is that pie and then divide it up, how much they each need to reduce their emissions. And so the focus for a long time has been to see if countries can agree their long-term emissions targets, economy-wide emissions targets. And it looks a bit different through Kyoto, Copenhagen, Paris, whatever, but all that's about the same. The difficulty was encountered almost straight away. After countries had this big convention and they said, right, let's now start negotiating over what we do, then they found that many countries didn't want their targets to be subject to international negotiation. It was too important, it was too difficult, they were too worried about how they'd meet them, and they said, we're not having that on the agenda. So right from the very start, the thing that was supposed to be the subject of agreement was not even on the agenda. And that's never changed. The Kyoto Agreement made it look as if it was on the agenda. It had countries' targets mentioned in the agreement, but in fact, they're all decided independently. Countries agreed that decided their own targets and then wrote them down in an international document that made it look as if they'd agreed them. And on average, they were about 5% emissions reductions over a 20-year period or so. Then the Copenhagen Agreement, which is famous mainly for having failed to be an agreement, was where people were really hoping that some of the big emerging economies like China and India would also do the same thing, set themselves targets, have them written into an international agreement and have that monitored. But that wasn't agreed. That was too difficult to agree. And so the process staggered on. And then the Paris Agreement, 2015, what is widely talked about as the biggest success of climate diplomacy, to me was actually an admission of failure. At that point, countries stopped even pretending to agree their emissions targets. They didn't even write them into the international agreement. They just said, we'll all do whatever we want, and then we'll tell each other. So you might have heard of nationally determined contributions. Those are the targets countries set themselves nationally. They don't discuss them, they don't negotiate them. They just set themselves on their own, and then they tell each other. And I often think, there's a reason why we don't do, for example, tax returns that way. You could have an agreement where we all do our tax returns by the 30th of January, but you can decide for yourself how much tax you pay or if, in fact, you want to claim a benefit instead. It doesn't tend to lead to very strong collective action. So for me, the Paris Agreement is the emperor's new climate treaty. Everybody says it's great because everybody else says it's great and everybody wants it to be great. But in fact, it doesn't really agree anything at all of substance. It just says we'll all tell each other what we're going to do and we'll do whatever we like. And meanwhile, in the 30 years while we've been trying and failing and eventually giving up the idea of negotiating these economy-wide emissions targets, that's still been the focus of diplomacy. If you look at what are governments lobbying each other on, when the prime ministers and presidents meet, when their officials tell them, you've got one thing you can say on climate change, what's it going to be? Typically, they're briefing them to lobby each other on these emissions targets. And the NGOs do it too, and the media reports it. So this is not everything that happens, but this is the central focus. Now, why is that wrong? Why has that turned out so badly? Three reasons. The first is scope. Diplomacy is only ever useful when it defines its scope at a manageable level, not too big. So, for example, we don't have an agreement on world peace. We don't even have negotiations. Nobody's trying to reach an agreement on world peace. They've done that once before. It was in 1928. It was called the Kellogg-Briand Pact. Countries agreed to renounce war as an instrument of national strategy, and that was in 1928. It wasn't wildly successful. We don't try that anymore. That's too big a scope. It's the same with poverty. We don't have a global agreement to end poverty. It's too big in scope. But when you have a manageable scope, you can. You can have a peace agreement in Northern Ireland. You can have development projects that do something useful for poverty reduction in particular places at particular times. So diplomacy is useful when the scope is right. With climate change taking the emissions across the whole economy, that's the broadest scope you can possibly have. It's too large. Nobody knows what to do at that level. You can't agree anything at all. So that's one reason. Second reason is participation. If everybody in this tent tried to agree which event at Greenbelt are we going to go and listen to next, it would be a long discussion and probably wouldn't end in agreement. The more people you have, parties to a negotiation, the lower the lowest common denominator. And what do we have in the UN climate change negotiations? 197 parties. Every country in the world and then some others that aren't even recognized as countries yet. We've made it as difficult as we possibly could in terms of participation. The third reason is a bit more subtle and it's to do with timescale. All of this focus on long-term targets. Now, why is that a problem? Well, one is that governments don't have much confidence what they can do in future. They don't know. Chinese government doesn't know what it can do by 2030, so it's very unwilling to commit to anything strong at that time, whereas it's got much more confidence in what it can do now, today. The other thing is interests change over time, and they change over the course of a technology transition. And my best example of this is China. In 2008, the Chinese government set itself a target of deploying solar power, and the target was 1.8 gigawatts by the year 2020. When they got to 2020, they deployed 252 gigawatts of solar power, 140 times as much as they thought. And what happened over that period of time? Well, one thing that happened is the more you invest in deploying a technology, the better it gets. The technology improves, more investment goes into it, the costs come down. So the interest changed from thinking this is just something that we can flog to the outside world, to these gullible Europeans and Americans, to thinking, no, this is quite useful. We can actually deploy this in China and get cheap electricity. So that interest changed over time. The other interest that changed was flogging it to the outside world turned out to be extremely successful. China went from exporting 4% of solar panels, 4% of the global market, to 70% in about a decade. And so that produced vested interests, industrial interests that were in favor of the transition. So that interest changed over time as well. This is what happens in every country. The interests are not static. So what really matters is not the targets, but the actions. What do we do today that makes it easier to do something else tomorrow that takes us in the direction we want to go in? So when you look at those three things together and you think the focus of climate change diplomacy over the last 30 years has been economy-wide scope, long-term targets, and universal participation, on those three measures, we've made the job as difficult as we possibly could. We've made climate change diplomacy as ineffective as we possibly could. And if we want to do better, then we need to move to the opposite corner. We need to be doing agreements that are focused on actions, not targets, that are focused on specific sectors of the global economy, like the steel sector or shipping or agriculture or road transport or electricity generation. Each of those things is completely different from the others. Different technologies, different problems, different ways that countries working together can make it easier for each other, make faster progress. And in terms of participation, we don't need every country in the world around the table. We don't need to give Saudi Arabia a veto over absolutely everything. Instead, just in each one of those emitting sectors, typically the top 10 countries make up about 3/4 of the global market. That's enough. And it's not the same countries in every sector. So actually these small groups can shift the global market and make it easier and cheaper for every other country to follow. That's the kind of diplomacy we need. Now, I've been making that argument for quite a while, for long enough to know some of the arguments against it. And I want to mention a couple of those and then spend the rest of the time I have on addressing them. Now, one argument is, okay, this international cooperation thing, it sounds nice, but surely that's just naive. Countries aren't really going to work together, are they? Look at what's happening in the world. Look at the state of relations between the US and China. They're on opposite sides of the Ukraine conflict. China is probably helping Russia. The US is obviously helping Ukraine. They're in extreme industrial competition as well as geopolitical competition. They've now got really steep tariffs against each other. When Trump put his first tariffs on trade from China, it was shocking. Nobody could quite believe what he was doing. And then Biden came along and he didn't remove them, he extended them. In many cases, he raised them. So that's the level of competition that's going on between the US and China. How can they possibly cooperate? How could I suggest that they would? That's one argument. It's impossible. The other argument is it's not really needed, that the economy is all about competition and this is a good thing. And look, America's just passed this thing they called the Inflation Reduction Act. They're spending about $400 billion on subsidies for solar panels, heat pumps, electric vehicles, all of that stuff. And they're doing it to compete with China and to try and win. And the EU's following, it's doing similar things. China and India are doing it too. And this might not be the economist's dream of a really great sort of free trade neoclassical thing where everything is produced where it's made cheapest. But hey, if we've got a clean technology subsidy race happening between the world's largest economies, surely that's a great thing. And that's going to push these technologies much further into markets, push the cost down, improve them, and all the rest. So that's the other argument, that cooperation is not needed. So let's just dwell for a second on the question of whether cooperation and competition are mutually exclusive. And first, a little bit of audience participation. If you watched any of the Olympic Games this summer, put your hand up. Thanks. So when you watch a running race, it's competition. It's extreme competition. They've all prepared for it for a long time. But it's also cooperation. For it to work, they have to agree, where do they start from? When do they start? Which direction are they going to run in? And where do they finish? If they don't cooperate on those points, you don't have a race. And you don't have the public value of the entertainment of watching the race. So it's cooperation in that point that makes competition deliver some kind of useful outcome. They're not mutually exclusive. If you think in the world of diplomacy, every single trade agreement is an act of cooperation in a context of competition. It shapes the competition to get better outcomes. Every peace agreement is an example of cooperation in a context of geopolitical competition. It stops that cooperation being destructive, and in some cases it makes it constructive instead. So they're not mutually exclusive. So the question isn't one or the other. The question is, how do the two coexist? How do those two interact? So there's no reason in principle to think that just because there's vicious competition out there in the world, cooperation on climate change is not possible. Now, to address the question of, is it necessary? Let's just look at the speed of the progress that we're making compared to what we need to make. Now, I wrote a book that came out last year, and it was called Five Times Faster. And the reason it was called that was, if we want to meet the internationally agreed target of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees C, then the rate of reduction of global emissions per unit GDP needs to be about 5 times faster this decade than it was on average over the past 2 decades. Now, I ran the numbers on that at the beginning of this decade. That's where the 5 times faster comes from. But we're now heading towards the end of 2024, and global emissions are still going up. They haven't started going down yet. So we've only got about half of this decade left. I need to refresh the numbers. I don't know. Is it 10 times faster now? Is it 8 times faster? I'm not sure, but it's a bloody lot faster. So in that context, surely we've got to try everything we can. We need strong local action. We need strong national action. And surely we have to have a shot at international cooperation. It would be a bit strange to take on the biggest challenge humanity has ever faced, a collective global challenge, and go, no, we're not going to bother with diplomacy. It looks like it might be difficult. Diplomacy is always difficult. Effective diplomacy is always difficult. Pretend diplomacy, ineffective diplomacy, is easy but pointless. So let's not carry on doing that. So to illustrate what I'm saying, I'm going to talk a bit about three examples, three of the big emitting sectors of the economy, and just talk about how cooperation and competition coexist in a slightly different way in each of those areas. So the first is the power sector, electricity generation. This is the biggest emitting sector in the global economy, and it's actually the one where we've made the most progress so far. The competition that is there is already competition over the new technologies. 80% of global power installations last year were solar or wind. So countries are not competing over coal plants and gas plants anymore. They're competing over solar and wind and some other clean technologies. And there are still tariffs in those areas. Biden increased American tariffs on Chinese solar panels from 25 to 50% earlier this year. The EU had industry lobbying for tariffs as well. That kind of dispute is still rumbling on. But actually, that doesn't really matter anymore. The reason why is that the clean technologies are already cheaper than the fossil fuels in most of the world. Solar and wind are cheaper than coal and gas. So a few tariffs here or there don't really matter. They're not going to change that. For the advanced countries, what's the critical thing in that transition right now? It's about market design. Our electricity market is designed around coal and gas plants. How do we design it around solar and wind? How do we pay long-term energy storage to be there so that in the UK it supplies power in the winter when it's dark and in times when it's not windy. Most of the time that won't even be being used. So what's the business case for that? What's the market design? That's the tough thing. And countries can work together on that question of market design at exactly the same time as suing each other over solar panels and international trade if they really want to. There's absolutely no conflict between those two things. For developing countries, though, they have a different problem in this transition. They have the problem of the cost of finance. As the solar panels and the wind turbines get cheaper and cheaper, the physical kit is getting cheaper, but the physical kit is becoming a smaller proportion of the overall cost. The larger proportions are now the things to do with installation, the price of land, and the cost of finance. If you're a poor country, the installation costs don't matter, labor's cheap, the cost of land doesn't have to be really expensive. The cost of finance is the thing you're really worried about. And you worry about it because the world doesn't trust you to handle money. So if you're in Germany, you can borrow at 3% to build a solar farm. If you're in Tunisia, it's going to cost you over 30%. And that interest rate's not entirely within your control. If somebody in the White House decides on a change of monetary policy, that's going to change interest rates and inflation rates around the world. It will influence the cost at which you can borrow. So that's making it really difficult for many, many countries to get on top of the transition to clean power. There's a way that they can be helped. There are many ways, but one of them is risk guarantees, where you have a public guarantee from a government or from a development bank that says, if this loan can't be repaid, we'll repay it. And there are many people in around the world that are beginning to argue for these to be taken more seriously. And there's evidence that these kind of public guarantees can enable investments that are up to 20 times the cost of the guarantee itself. So when you think, well, rich countries have already committed to stumping up some money to help developing countries in the transition, well, if they can do it in a way that gets 20 times the investment of the amount of money that they put in, that's a really good way of doing it. Again, no reason why countries can't cooperate on that, even when they're viciously competing in other areas. The USA, China, Europe, they're all shareholders in the World Bank. They're all putting money into that system. There's no reason they couldn't cooperate to enable risk guarantees to help a lot of other countries make faster progress in the transition to clean power. So that was the power sector. Second one I want to talk about is cars. This is kind of my favorite one because I like cars. But it's also one where we're doing fairly well. Last year, electric vehicles made up 18% of car sales globally, nearly a fifth. And that's up from only 5% 3 years earlier. So this transition is also really gathering pace. But it's not over the hump yet. It's not yet at the place where the new technology fully outcompetes the old. Electric vehicles are still a lot more expensive than petrol cars. And many people don't own them yet for that reason. Now, there is a way that the largest countries in the world could work together and make it easier for each other. And the reason is, just like most clean technologies, the more you deploy it, the more you use it, the more you make it, the cheaper it gets, because the technology keeps on improving with investment. And we've already been making batteries and electric vehicles long enough to have a sense of what that relationship is. How much does cost come down with cumulative production? Because of that, we can model. What would happen if countries worked together in a different way? And I worked with a few academics to model this, and we said, what will happen if the US, China, and Europe aligned their regulations on a trajectory towards all new cars being zero emission by 2035, which is roughly when they'd need to be in line with a net zero scenario? And we found if they did that, then because of the bigger economies of scale and the faster technological learning, they would bring forward that tipping point, the tipping point of cost parity, where the clean technology is cheaper than the fossil fuel technology, and they could bring it forward by up to 5 years. That would make it cheaper and easier for all of them. Now, is that unrealistic to expect? Those three markets, US, China, and EU, between them, they make up well over half the global car market, so they'd shift the entire industry if they did it that way. Is that impossible? Well, I don't think it should be, because if you look at Europe, countries within the EU have already done that. They've already agreed on that trajectory themselves. And there's no less competition between the car makers in Germany and France and Italy and Spain. They're all not holding hands and giving up market share to each other. They're competing as hard as they ever have done. But they agreed on the pace of the transition in the global market at the same time as competing to supply it. No reason why the larger powers couldn't do the same. Another challenge that's come up to do with cars is that China, it turns out, has been doing what all of us should have been doing, which is taking every step possible to encourage the industry in electric vehicles. And they've been so successful that everybody else is getting scared. Last year, China made up to 60% of the world's electric vehicles by one estimate. The US is so scared of this that they've put tariffs of 100% on imported Chinese electric vehicles. And the EU has also added, theirs are a bit more confusing, but somewhere in the range of 25 to 50%. A really steep tariff, which is going to make it more expensive for you or me to buy a Chinese electric vehicle, which is probably the best and cheapest electric vehicle that we could buy. And presumably none of us want Teslas anymore because Elon Musk is being too much of a So this is making it more difficult, but there's precedent for handling this kind of situation. In the 1980s, everybody was scared of Japanese car makers because they seemed to have found a way to make them more efficient and more reliable, and that went against Western tradition of making them huge and unreliable. And so again, America and Europe put up tariffs, they put up quotas, they really restricted the Japanese imports, but they didn't block the Japanese industry entirely. In fact, they said, we'd like to encourage you to come and invest in our country, because when you do that, you share the benefits. The Japanese companies got the big profits, but the jobs went to America and Europe. And that's why we have Nissan in Sunderland and we have Toyota in Swindon or wherever it is. This is how it worked. That's how that was dealt with. And it worked out well for everybody. So again, the same could be done with the Chinese car makers and battery makers. Let's not reject them entirely, but let's invite them to come and invest in the UK. And in fact, around this part of the country has some of the best automotive engineering of anywhere in the UK. We should be inviting Chinese investment in here. Get the jobs, let them help us have the cheap cars. So that was the second one. The third I want to mention is steel. And steel is one of a handful of energy-intensive industries that together make up about 20% of global emissions. So it's a really big chunk. It's a really important set of industries that we need to deal with. But this is an area where we've made hardly any progress so far. If you look at steel, clean technology has about 0.1% of the global market. 99.9% is fossil fuels. So we've got everything still to do. The reason why we've made so little progress is there's a competitive international market. We sell steel to each other internationally very much. And the problem is steel produced in a zero emission way is going to be more expensive than the fossil fuel steel for the foreseeable future, significantly more expensive. And if you sell more expensive steel on the global market, you go bust and you don't have a steel industry anymore. That's why we've done nothing. In the UK, we've had an ingenious scheme for about the last, 10 or 15 or years or so, where we have carbon pricing, but then we also have a rebate. We sort of give them back the money so that they'll be okay and they won't be hurt in the international competition. A lot of European countries are doing similar things. And most countries around the world, at best, they've just made fossil fuel steel a bit more efficient. They've barely started yet to produce any near zero emission steel. So it's very difficult to see how we will ever have a transition in the steel industry, in the steel sector, unless we have some kind of international agreement on trade. You need to stop it being the case that competition is a brake on the transition, and you need to shift competition towards the new technology. So it's an accelerator of the transition. That means a trade deal that either has everybody having the same carbon price on steel or having standards where we say you can only sell steel into the global market if it has a carbon content below a certain threshold. Now, that's going to be really difficult to negotiate, But trade deals always are, and it's very difficult to see how this transition happens without one. So the focus should be beginning to discuss what does that trade agreement look like and take the confidence-building measures, work together on the technology demonstration, help on the steps like public procurement that create the first market and the signals for investment, get some near-zero emission steel absolutely deployed. And again, the astonishing thing, I was saying there have been 30 years of climate change diplomacy. In all of that time, how many times have the biggest steel-producing countries in the world sat down together around the table and said, how shall we bring about a transition to zero-emission technologies in the global steel industry? I can tell you, never. They haven't done it yet. They didn't try and find it too difficult. They haven't yet even begun to try. So this is what I mean, why I say it's a bit like me playing tennis. It's pretty bad. There's a long way to go. So in all three of those examples, the ways of cooperating that I've talked about can make it easier for countries. They can make it cheaper, and they can make it less difficult to make progress towards zero emissions. That's the kind of diplomacy we need to be doing. Plurilateral, action-focused, and within small groups, within the critical mass of countries that can shift things in each of those sectors. So I've been talking about this global approach and diplomacy, and sometimes that can seem a bit disconnected from what we can do individually or even what we can do as a country. So I want to, towards the end of this talk, just bring it a bit more home. Think about how do we influence that. Now, as the UK, we obviously have our net zero target, net zero by 2050. We have our carbon budgets for each 5 years, and we have some policies, not as many as we'd all like, but we have some that are trying to move us in that direction. Why do we do all of that? What's it for? We're 1% of global emissions. In fact, we're less than that. So why are we going for net zero emissions by 2050? Is it so that we can get to 2050 and give ourselves a pat on the back? Is it so that we don't get shouted at in UN climate change negotiations? Or is it so that we, in some way, limit the risk of climate change to ourselves in the UK, to the rest of the world, to our children, to anybody else that we care about? I actually was doing a presentation to a government on the other side of the world a month or so ago, and I facetiously put this in a slide pack, and I said, tick the box, which one of those do you think is the right reason? And I worried, is this a bit too rude and a bit too much of a piss take? But one of them actually in the Q&A, the person who was the climate director in this government's environment ministry, said to me, I hadn't really thought about it like that before. I thought it actually was just so that we didn't get shouted at in the UN. It's amazing. You'd think this was obvious, but it's not. The only reason that we reduce emissions in the UK is to reduce the risk to ourselves and everybody else from climate change. But how does that work? What's the causal mechanism that achieves that? It's not UK emissions come down, therefore risk to the UK come down. It only works if what we do influences the global economy. It brings about faster change in the global economy, and therefore global emissions go down, and that reduces the risk to us. So everything we do is utterly pointless unless we really find a good way to leverage it, to get it to work through the global economy, to influence other countries. In other words, it's a general principle of mine. It's not about our footprint. It's about our leverage. What do we do that changes the bigger system of which we're a part? So let's relate that to one or two policies or potential policies of the incoming government. We have a new government. They're very keen to do stuff about climate change and to be better than their predecessors. Hooray, good for them. Their headline target is zero emissions in the UK power system by 2030. That's insanely difficult, but good on them for thinking we should give it a go. We were aiming for 2035 before. That was already difficult. They've brought it forward 5 years. But the question is, how are we going to do that in a way that helps other countries come too? Because if we achieve it by 2030 and then after that we go, oh, right, now let's talk to other countries about how we did it, it's too late. We need to be working with China and India, the countries with the biggest amounts of coal power burning in their electricity systems, need to be working with them now. And over the last decade or so, I've seen the funding cut from our embassies around the world where they used to run small projects to share learning on this kind of thing with other countries. I've seen the locally engaged staff, the Chinese staff who worked in our embassy in China, be let go because the budget for them was cut as well. They were the people with all the institutional knowledge. And I speak to the people in the UK Energy Department who are leading this really thoughtful, ambitious program of power sector reform. And I say, what are your plans for engagement with other countries? And they say, oh, we don't really have any plans. Nobody's really asked. So if we're going to get any value out of this thing that the new government has staked a lot of political capital on and will spend a lot of money on and will put a lot of civil service time into, then we've got to be investing in the way that that is done together with other countries at the same time. A second example I'd give, our steel industry. We have not much of it left, as people will know. But the last government was preparing some pretty big subsidies, 250 million, something like that for Port Talbot, something similar maybe for Scunthorpe. Big slugs of money to try and keep them alive for a little bit longer. Should we do that or not? Should we subsidize an industry that's been declining in this country for a long time? I actually think, yes, we should. And the reason why is not really because there'll be lots of jobs in this country selling steel in future. There probably won't. But because this is such an important sector of the global economy to change that we want to have a dog in this fight. We want to have a seat at the table when countries come together, finally, eventually, to discuss how to shift the global steel industry. And in fact, we want to have a role in bringing them to the table. Why shouldn't we be the country that brings the EU, America, China, Brazil, India to the table to have that discussion for the very first time? Why not? And if we hang on to a bit of a steel industry, we still have the legitimacy to do that. And let's invest seriously in some new technology for primary production of near zero emission steel, not just recycling. Because there are loads of these recycling plants all over the world already. Nobody will learn anything from another one of those based in Port Talbot. Let's go seriously, build the real thing, do the new stuff. That's what we need to do. So what does this mean for any of us individually? Well, I think that principle I mentioned of change on climate change being less about footprint and more about your point of leverage, it applies even more strongly as you come down in scale. For countries, their footprint is still pretty important, especially big countries. But if you're a business or an NGO or a church or a university or an individual, it's your leverage that really matters. What can you do better than most people could do to change the system that you're a part of? And this applies very much. It applies on every level and it applies to everything I was just saying about diplomacy. If you're a business, don't just tell the government what does it need to do to change things in your sector within the UK. Tell them how is it that they could work with other countries that would change your sector of the global economy even more quickly. And even on the individual level, of course, many of us, there are all kinds of different ways we can act on climate change. But the one point of leverage that absolutely everybody has in this country is our vote, our citizenship. And if you want the government to do more, then make sure they know. When I worked for a minister, Andrea Leadsom, who at that time was the energy minister back in 2016, she got more letters from the public complaining about noisy wind farms than she did get letters saying, please, would you do something serious on climate change? So if you want the government to do something, do write to them, do tell them. If you think we should be more serious about climate change diplomacy, then tell them that. Tell them it should be focused on practical action, deal with real things, not just emissions targets, but things like power systems and cars and steel plants. Get dead serious about that. And I said this was a hopeful session. So the final comment I want to make is that if you focus on reducing your footprint, which is a good thing to do, and I'm not against it, there's a limit to what you can do. Apparently, there's a study by professors in the US that said, if you're a homeless person living off soup kitchens in the US, then you still have an unsustainable carbon footprint. If you somehow manage to do even better and you eliminate it, well, still the most you can do is just eliminate that footprint. But if you're focused on your leverage, what is the best thing that you can do and how do you apply that to the problem of climate change? How do you change the bigger system around you? There is actually no intrinsic limit to what you can achieve. So I think that's a hopeful way of thinking about it. I'll stop there and then let's have some discussion. Thanks.
So we've got, we've got 10 minutes. Let's start over here.
Thank you for those comments about sectoral discussions. How do you deal with the vested interests that are seeking to undermine the change that we all need?
Thanks. Great question. My main answer to that is bypass them. Don't try and agree anything with Saudi Arabia or Russia. They're too against it. But one important thing is within every country, there is a mixture of interests. Even in Saudi Arabia, there'll be some people fighting for the transition, so I shouldn't be overly rude about them. Good example is Brazil on the forests. Half of the country wants to burn down the Amazon more quickly. The other half wants to protect it. So the job of climate change diplomacy is not to treat a country as one entity. It's to recognize what interests in that country are there that you can work with and work with them, help them win their fights. There's another answer to this question, which is really important, which is you actually don't fight climate change by pressing the oil companies to keep the oil in the ground. We all want them to do that, but they never will. They have a valuable thing and they will dig it up and they will sell it as much as they possibly can. And our own policy in the UK on the North Sea is called maximize economic recovery. It means dig up as much of the bloody fossils as you can and keep flogging them until no one wants to buy them. That's the policy of every country that has fossils. The way you deal with it, the way you bypass those vested interests is you act on the demand, not the supply. You change our power system so that we now have solar and wind and offshore wind and all that stuff instead of coal. The last coal power plant is about to close its doors forever in this country. Hooray! And then we don't buy coal from Colombia anymore. We don't buy coal from Russia anymore. We don't need it. Same with the transition in cars I was talking about. If you want to just stop oil, if you want to keep the oil in the ground, let's move faster in the transition to electric vehicles. That's the way we do it. The oil companies cannot do anything about it. They can only stand back and watch.
Is there any mileage in a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty?
My main answer to that is no, for exactly the reason I was just saying, that there is an initiative that's been started along those lines. In fact, more than one. One of them is called the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance, started by the Danes. And they started it because they've finished selling all of their oil and gas. So I think it's going to be impossible to agree that. However, I'd say that's only part of an answer. And I think I should also say, in this kind of enormous challenge, it's worth trying it from every angle. And if that discussion around a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty can achieve anything, it would be a gradual contribution to the change in norms in society that is happening. So I think it's not wrong, but I think it's most important to act on the points of greatest leverage, which is acting on demand.
So I'm going to take a question to the front here, and then I'd like the next person not to look like the other three, no disrespect. But... I really want to ask if there's any younger people here who have a question, because it's your future that we're talking about. So any younger people who are here, I'll come and find you.
Okay, so I'll try and not be too long. But at one point you said that the headline target is zero emissions in power by 2030. How do you do that? And what I've been sort of like thinking a lot about is like how do we do zero carbon camping? You know, I reckon that we're going to be like on our gas stoves, and we've all got gas stoves. We're going to burn at least like 10 tons of CO2, and how, when what's that going to be like by 2030? Do you think it's possible that we, as Greenbelters, who are actually keen on this kind of thing, could actually develop ways of doing true zero carbon camping and leverage that, okay, across, even if it's at a, like a, like you said, any scale was important. Could we do that, do you think?
Well, I suppose my honest answer is I don't know. I'm not sure what you'd do about a gas stove that you use outside your tent. Really not sure. It might be possible that you could use biogas, and that might be a way of doing it that's zero emission. But there's problems with all kind of biofuels, which is that actually it's a very limited global supply, and we should use them where we really need them, where we can't think of anything else, like plastics and maybe aviation, but use them as little as possible. And it may be possible that one day we have to say, well, we don't really use camping stoves. We use, you know, something else. I don't really have the answer to that. I think, though, it is important. Scale does matter. And the reason I mentioned the footprint leverage thing is it applies. It's really important. You know, often people say, well, look at all these ridiculous people getting on plane flights and going to an international conference on climate change. You know, surely they should not do that and stay at home. I disagree. I'm one of those people, so you can say I'm, you know, self-serving in saying this. But I think if you're going to solve a global problem, you need to meet up and talk about it. And I know that that works better when you do it face to face. So I think that needs to happen. And in the same way, I'd say, what's the value of Greenbelt? How should Greenbelt think about its role in respect of climate change? Well, anything it does to reduce its footprint is good, but anything it does to use its leverage is better. And what is its leverage? It's bringing together this kind of community. It's people coming together, having talks, thinking about things, talking to each other, and going away and doing something else that is valuable and powerful. That's its real leverage. I've been to a few festivals and I've never been to another one that has so much kind of campaign-y spirit as Greenbelt does. So I think, you know, that's what Greenbelt should double down on. Do more of this.
Hello. Okay, so two questions, if that's all right. So the first one is, how do we make sustainable living not seem like something that is for more middle-class people, like being able to afford to have a clear conscience? And how do we make it accessible for those who are on the breadline, who are maybe choosing between energy and food, looking into as well around, you know, organics and things like that, that not a lot of people can afford? And then the second part of it is, what do you think about the certification of organics and of foods like that? Do you think that it's a good mechanism for accountability and insurance of like good product, or do you think that they're blocking people that or businesses that aren't able to pay those kind of fees but would also like to work in the same kind of sustainability area?
Yeah, okay, thanks. So on sort of, is sustainability a middle class thing or is, yeah, I think it's important to recognize that there are already ways in which clean technologies are creating opportunities for poverty reduction and development in ways that fossil fuels didn't achieve. One of those ways is the microgrids of solar power that are happening in lots of African countries and South Asia, bringing electricity to people that didn't have it before. Another way, I know there's a great example in India where the government introduced some really powerful policies to move from incandescent lighting to LED lighting, and eventually made it much cheaper than the old form of lighting had been, brought lighting to many houses for the first time, allowed people to study in the evenings and so on. So there isn't necessarily an inherent conflict. But of course, there are still lots of things that are expensive. Electric vehicles are expensive. Heat pumps are expensive. I think the approach that they've taken in America recently under the Biden administration is quite a good example of how you can address that, which is really strongly weighting the subsidies towards the poorer households. I think if you're a poor household in America, you can get a load of this stuff virtually for free. Home insulation upgrade, heat pump, solar panel on the roof. I don't think they'll give you a free Tesla, but we don't want them anymore, right? but you get a lot of it for free. And of course, there's a huge amount you can do with tax and subsidy policy within a country that is redistributive. And I suppose an overall point I'd make on this is we tend to think about, oh God, this is all expensive. How do we allocate the expense? How do we share the burden? Actually, the problem's the opposite. Globally, the most up-to-date modeling by the scientists at Oxford is that a fast global transition to a clean economy will save around $12 trillion globally by 2050 compared to carrying on burning fossil fuels. So the problem is not how do you allocate the burden, the problem is how do you allocate the saving across people, across time, across countries, across places. How do you allocate that saving? That's the real problem. So there are great opportunities to do that in a way that is redistributive and that helps poorer households. On the farming and the organic certification question, I think that's going a bit beyond my area of expertise. But the thing I'd say is agriculture is one of these sectors, like the energy intensive industries, where very little progress has been made. The brilliant experiments in all kinds of places with organic farming, but on the national scale and the international scale, hardly any progress yet. So it's another one where I think we have to encourage the experiments, but we also have to look at scale, and scale is going to involve some very serious national subsidy or regulatory policies and international trade agreements that go with that.
Huge thanks on behalf of all of us and the festival to Simon for coming back and for sharing what he has.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.